Well, hi, welcome back to the Concurrent podcast about concurrent and parallelism in .NET. I'm Steve Bjork, the founder and chief architect at MindTouch.
And I'm Arne Klassen, senior developer at MindTouch. Today we're going to talk a bit more of a meta topic than the technology itself, and that is, why should you care about asynchronous programming? How does it really benefit you, and the complications that it brings, are they worth doing in the first place?
Yes, because that was actually some feedback we got on the podcast that we did previously, which was about locking and lock-free data structures. And some people were responding, it's like, well, you know, I'm doing ASP.NET code, or I'm doing client-side code, and this whole asynchronous talk, parallelism, how does it apply to me? And so this was great feedback, because, of course, we do it all the time, and we think it's the way of the future, but justifying it and actually determining, you know, convincing others that, oh, this is something that they should pay attention to and understand that this is something that they will run into, if not today, tomorrow, is important enough that we need to address it.
Yeah, I started thinking a little bit about kind of traditional ASP.NET programming and just web programming that I've done in the past. And where would I ever run into more than one thread? And you never really spawn another thread, but you might make a call to another service. Generally, that's the database, and you might not have any control over doing that asynchronously, so you're going to block on the database. And that's one of the big things with most applications, that they're front ends for some kind of database. But we're definitely moving into a world where the data that you're presenting and the calculations that you're doing are based on other services that are not under your control, that are living somewhere else in the cloud. And at that point, the whole idea of I'm calling something, it may not return any time I want to, it may not return ever, or it may return with just bad information, not necessarily in an error code, but just an HTTP response that is incorrect, and being able to handle that without sucking up all the threads on your machine and basically bringing down your server. That's kind of where asynchronous programming in many ways will become important, even if it isn't today for you.
Yeah, I mean, you just said that, you know, we're not aware of threads in ASP.NET programming, but the reality is every single request that you answer is actually being served by the thread pool. So when you program, you are really using up multiple threads. And the asynchronous programming is today prevalent in the setting of, you know, high-performance computing, because threads are so expensive. The reality is, as soon as you start having more than 100 or even 1,000 threads, you run quickly into limitation of the system. You're just being excessively hungry on system resources, be it the thread scheduler, the amount of which memory that is allocated per thread that is allocated, that is spun up, are all things that will basically degrade your performance as your throughput goes up. Now, this is a server-side limitation, or you know, I mean, that's one of the problems we run when we do server-side software. But there's similar problems also on client-side software when we start talking to other devices and so on. I mean, talking to the disk or the database, as you just mentioned, and I'll get back to the client-side later on. The reality is, if we look at the there's a hierarchy of performance changes when you start talking to different storage devices. And the difference between talking to the cache and talking to the memory is as big as talking to the memory and the hard disk. It really starts making a huge difference in performance. So having lower requirements on your system resources does translate to bigger performance. Now, I remember you raised a good point a while back, which was like, well, why worry about it? Because, I mean, if I don't improve my code, I can always just add a few servers to the data center.
You always see this kind of optimization of like, oh, we're going to make it faster so we can get more out of the hardware. And you go, well, programming time is really expensive versus I can throw another server in a data center in no time. I mean, that's really not a problem.
Absolutely.
So you're not going to run any problems with that. Although, what you see a lot where people go, oh, we're going to have to throw another server into the pool because we're overloading. Chances are that that server actually has a lot of headroom you're not using. But let's assume that money isn't the problem and you could use more and more servers. Just because you can get more service still doesn't alleviate the problems of, in a distributed world, your calls to other services are going to just become a bottleneck that you can't scale out of with just machines.
Yep, that's one argument. And the other argument is there's actually a strong correlation between high performance and power consumption. So in certain settings, like embedded devices especially, the reality is you can't add another device. It is what it is. And you have to make do with what is there and scale up more efficiently. So asynchronous program, I think today, while we are embracing inside MindTouch to programming style, and we do server-side software, so it makes so much sense, it is really just trickling down to the general population. We aren't yet seeing as much a need for people to have to cope with that complexity. And it certainly increases the complexity. I mean, when we debug our code, I mean, we actually... Exactly.
Yeah.
While you're laughing, I'll add to that. When we debug our code, I mean, we have actually added facilities in Dream to make it easier to trace things back and so on and to correlate things. And even then, we only enable them programmatically. It's basically, if you run the DreamOS console, you can push the D button, and it will start the first time around, it will start tracking a certain amount of information. The second time around, it will start tracking call stacks. So when it sees that certain asynchronous operations are being started or completed, it actually captures both call stacks. You can see, well, where the hell did this come from? And of course, your performance goes to shit at that moment. Because, I mean, tracking call stack on every async operation is just terrible. But unfortunately, sometimes it's absolutely necessary to debug these things because you no longer have the benefit of a clean call stack where you can see, oh, method A called method B called method C, and something happened in method C. In asynchronous programming, all you will see is method C has been invoked by the dispatch thread and failed. Okay, who the hell invoked method C? And because it is non-blocking, you can't go to the other threads and just see, well, you know, I'm going to look at one of those and see what state they're in. They're not there.
Yeah, I've tried that as well. Just be like, okay, I have all these threads. Which one is the one that I actually came from? And it might just not be there. Because it might be in the queue waiting to be dispatched on yet another thread. And I think we're all sort of in a painful period right now that, well, I would hope that tool vendors will eventually address. Because the reason why it's painful is not necessarily because it is impossible to have good tooling for it. It's just that all tooling out there, and I don't think I've seen anything else outside of Visual Studio Eclipse or anything else, that even considers tracking an invocation chain. Everything is based on, well, here's a stack. Well, I can look back on the stack to see where I came from. And with asynchronous programming, you don't have a stack. You're always going to do a small little bit, and you're going back there. But you want to get that chain of where did we start and what different coroutines did we hop through to get here. I'm kind of getting a little bit off topic by going into coroutines and other things that...
But coroutines are a mechanism that we use to make asynchronous programming a little bit more digestible to our poor little brains.
Right, but it's not even a feature that is in .NET. We've kind of strapped it on top of it, so
correct. We
don't want to be confusing everybody with something that we'll cover in another podcast.
Yeah, in more details. But yeah, coroutine is something that we probably will be mentioning repeated at different times because we have put a lot of effort into making them easier to work with and program. But so I do know that the CCR, the Concurrency Coordination Runtime, it used to be called the Common Concurrency Runtime, but I guess it wasn't that common after all, so I changed the name, which was written by my good friend George at Microsoft in large part, uses a causation field to correlate consequences of causes and so on, so that they have somewhat of an idea what follows what, and they have a way of visualizing it. So they have done a lot of work in terms of that. I think the rest of the .NET team is still catching up and putting in the right kind of work. It will be interesting what the .NET team does, which kind of is attacking a similar problem at first blush, but not quite. Namely, parallel .NET is always following the same pattern, which is farm out many threads like the for each parallel for each of these max parallelism, and then merge all the results back on a single thread, join basically the threads, which is a synchronization point. And very often the way it is expressed is in the context of a single method, which basically means it's blocking code. There's no other way to do it in the context of a single method. You have to have a callback, or you have to use the yield return pattern to really do asynchronous coding today in .NET.
And yield really wasn't quite built for that, actually. Eric Lippert over at Microsoft just had a nice thread of blog posts about yields and what it really does. And it basically, it wasn't built as a full coroutine pattern. More like an enumeration pattern. We've kind of stretched it to its limits for doing what we want to. Parallel.NET team and how they're going to address this problem, I would imagine just from history, is it's going to come out with 4.0 and be in 2010, and people are going to feel the pain. And we're probably not until 2011 or whatever the next version of Visual Studio is, will we see any kind of tooling that really goes along with it. We have, you've seen it several times with .NET, where something really innovative came into the framework. And
the V1, basically.
Right, it's kind of like, hey, here it is, and the Visual Studio team didn't get to catch up with it because they were on their own schedule. They're like, okay, it works. Oh, you need to do debugging with that. Yeah, that's another problem.
Or the other way, it's oh, wait, you actually didn't need all this mechanics, something else is much more, a smaller problem is actually a much better fit for the market, like Windows Presentation Foundation and Silverlight, which share a lot in common, but at the end of the day, Silverlight is a lightweight version of WPF.
Well, and until Silverlight came out, we really didn't get the tooling, because in 2005 was WPF already, but oh my god, the editor for XAML was absolutely atrocious. And then 2008 came out, and Silverlight started coming out, and finally we started seeing some tooling that made it worthwhile. And I guess 2010 is going to be the third stage where the editor is actually written in WPF and there's some dog fooding going on. It'll be painful for everybody.
But just like the point that you're making, it will be the first generation parallel editor coming out. And so I think it's actually 2012 afterwards.
Yeah.
If I understood correctly the timeline for Visual Studio. So, So asynchronous programming, the primary use case that is always out there that people throw out, and then suddenly the first one that comes to my mind is always performance. We're talking about, we don't want to block these threads. We want to take as little resource on the system as possible. But there's also a very different compelling property of asynchronous code, and that is decoupling of responsibilities, of contracts, if you will. In synchronous code, if I put myself into a caller environment, so I call you as another method or function, I'm basically now entirely stuck by whenever you return. You may return with a value or an exception. That's fine. At least you return. But if you do not return, if you get into a blocked state, a stuck state, I cannot uphold my contract to the outside world anymore. Versus in asynchronous programming, we do have that nice property that fundamentally we assume that things can take a certain period of time or may never finish. And every asynchronous call, at least in the Dream framework, unless otherwise explicitly mentioned, has a 10-minute timeout. So 10 minutes seems to be very, very long at first, right? Because we're talking about milliseconds, or microseconds for a call to complete. But here's the nice thing about 10 minutes. 10 minutes seems to be an eternity for a computer. But it does mean that things will terminate over time and the system will clean itself up. That's why we have that 10-minute timeout. And if you're doing a large copy operation, it can take an hour of download or something, then you can provide a custom timeout and it's much higher. But in general, every async operation has a timeout. We know that, look, we don't want to get stuck on this. We want to make sure that things get released. And the alternative to the timeout mechanism of asynchronous calls is, of course, suspending or aborting a thread, which, at least up to .NET 2.0, I don't know if they've done any work afterwards, but the problem was it could actually, when you aborted a thread, it would even abort it while it was doing an unmanaged call, which, of course, can leave your system in a completely unknown state, and so your application pretty much has to shut down at that point. If it were a little bit more, like, hey, as soon as you come back from unmanaged and go to managed, we saw an uncatchable exception, like the fail fast, and we shut down that thread and make sure that nothing can catch it in between and we roll everything up, maybe then it would be safer. But short of that, we have to have this dialogue where I'm telling you, basically, you have this much time, and if you don't, then I'm going to come back and I'm just going to continue on with my execution and say, look, I couldn't complete what I was asked to do. I had to complete it in an alternative way, by maybe storing to disk instead of uploading it to a server, and give my caller the ability to continue its work.
Yeah, I don't think that really much has been done with aborting threads, just because in V1, abort was an actual call on thread, and with V2, it became deprecated, so it's at least not discouraged, and if they did actively discourage it by deprecating, I'm assuming it's still not a clean thing to do.
Yeah.
And that
it never has been in any OS.
I know, but, well, in 1.0, when I started with it, I'm like, well, I'm going to do join with a timeout, and then if it doesn't come back, I'll just abort it, because, well, I can. So that must be okay. And never really thought twice about it at that point in time. And now,
well, as long as you do it actually manage, I think it is okay. The problem is when manage calls unmanaged, you may call back to manage and so on, but basically you have some unmanaged bit in there, so there's nothing the framework can do about it.
Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah, but this property is basically what I started thinking about hinting at earlier when I was talking about client applications. Namely, you know, look at you doing a client application that talks to, like, iTunes, and it talks to a device, it talks to a web server. Cloud computing is going to increase this kind of environment where these kind of problems can occur, and the thing is just not responding in a reasonable amount of time. You have to be able to write your code in a way that it is chronologically decoupled. So we've also talked about, you know, behavior decoupling, where, you know, we create these interfaces and so on. But I think what asynchronous coding is really promoting fundamentally is this chronological decoupling, where we say, look, this operation doesn't have to just accomplish a certain feat or task. It has to do so in a certain amount of time. And I have to get back to my user and so on. And my application has to be in a known state. And in order to achieve that, there's a whole lot of little moving parts that get involved that are very fundamental, I believe, to asynchronous programming. So in general, when we talk about asynchronous programming, we talk about the programming paradigm in terms of calling things and getting a return value. But as we will cover in future podcasts as well, the whole issue about, you know, state isolation and so on, about how to deal with things in such a way that we do know that if things go bad, what state we will go towards.
Right.
Which is, I think, is just as fundamental to asynchronous programming.
And so many more desktop applications at this point are really rich interfaces to some kind of web services. And the moment you have that, you can't have something that you can, like, okay, if the web doesn't come back, I'm going to die or puke or something. I mean, people are used to hitting the reload button on a web page, but when they're running something like iTunes or... And I'm not trying to hold up iTunes because...
it does have its problems, yes.
Well, but it is one of the premier rich clients for a web service in many ways. I mean,
yeah.
Before many other people were doing it.
It is an alternative browser for all practical purposes.
Exactly. It's a rich media. It's a browser optimized for music and, I guess, video now as well. But all those kind of things, users expect desktop applications to be responsive and be able to recover. You don't want to close down an application just because a web service doesn't come back. And that's kind of the big thing about the async pattern is, when you're calling a method, you're calling something that's under your control. So you're saying, well, it's going to come back. Because if it doesn't come back, then that code was written wrong. But if you're depending on a server that lives somewhere else, you have so many other things in there. I mean, your network connection could be bad, or something on the routing goes bad, or you're hitting it while they're doing an upgrade, and you just really, even with an SLA in place, you don't know what's going to happen, and you need to not only be able to go, okay, it hasn't come back in the time that we define in our SLA, well, okay, that's bad for them, and we're going to call them and say bad. But that doesn't mean that I don't have to get back to my customer with some kind of result. Maybe I'll call an alternative service or make something up or something.
Well, and you don't want the result to be, sorry, an error happened, you need to terminate the application now.
Right.
That's just not acceptable. That means that you have to go back to a known state to be really reliable.
Yes.
And that's why things like abort thread and so on, they just don't work. You don't get that guarantee of a known state on the outcome.
Yeah.
So I think when it comes to asynchronous programming, I think definitely at MindTouch we are pushing the envelope of what is currently the state of the art for asynchronous programming in the .NET framework. There's a lot of great research being done at Microsoft. and others in general in the field of asynchronous programming models and programming languages. One of them is not Maestro. that's a topic for when we talk about actors in parallel and data flow. We'll get back to that. But when people are exploring these different models, like CCR, I think did some interesting work in that respect, where their fundamental approach is it's all about coordination, not concurrency. And that's definitely something we need to talk about in the future. However, the concurrence and asynchronicity are, there's overlap, but it's not entirely the same. I mean, you can have concurrent code, which is highly synchronous. Concurrency does not imply...
Well, I think that synchronicity comes in once you start talking about distributed. Because synchronous concurrency works well on a massively parallel machine, right?
Yep.
A 64-core machine. Oh, you can make a lot of synchronous assumptions, but the moment you say there's a machine over across the network boundary, at that point, you really got to go into asynchronous code because there's too many factors that you have no control over, no bus that you know, you don't know what the transport speed is and all these kind of things. And so having the ability to recover and time out becomes vital.
Yeah, I think so. And it's manifested particularly strongly in the kind of software that we write, which is, you know, web server software. And we talk in a cloud environment. We talk to other web services. It's just requests going left and right. We have to have a good handle over failure points. And failure points in this case are invocation points. You know, when you call another method, you don't think that that method is unreachable.
Right.
For whatever reason. Whereas in a distributed setting, especially in a cloud setting, that is the reality. And the challenge with asynchronous code is the tool set that you pointed out earlier.
Yeah.
It's the code does look and smells different.
And that's almost tooling as well, because I'm going to assume...
Well,
that
that's the language, that's the technology.
Right, but
you
I think...
the right technology, the next... not the tools to debug it, right?
What I almost think of language syntax as another part of the tooling.
Okay.
I'm going to assume that over the next couple of years, there's going to be languages that are built on top of concurrency, just basically built in with timeouts for method calls.
Yeah, and hopefully not five different patterns at once, like this other language that I mentioned earlier, but specifically certain patterns that have been proven to be very effective in practice. So we're really pushing the boundary there, and we're kind of encountering these problems early on just because of the very setting in which we write software. But I do strongly believe that, you know, it's coming down kind of the pipe. And while we may be hitting it early and we have to take these things into consideration early, because we do write, you know, software for servers that serve millions of pages a day, which not everybody has to do, the problem does seem to be, it seems to be almost impossible to avoid that it won't come into clients and other kinds of environments where your primary concern may not be concurrency, it is quality of experience that you need to deal with. And the experience is relying on third parties providing certain services. I mean, be it, you know, a Twitter client, be it iTunes-like client, I mean, more and more stuff.
Database.
Yes, more and more stuff is out in the cloud. And just showing an ugly error message, taking too long, not being able to fill it in later on, not being able to deal with cancellation, which is a very complicated problem, namely where an outer context that called an inner context, so I called you, and then for whatever reason I realized in between, like, whoops, hold on a second, actually, don't bother. There's a whole lot of little problems, and I'm going to be writing a page on it. And once it's ready, it will be published on our blog at blog.developer.mindset.com. But these are really interesting problems, and these are problems we did not have when our worldview was the call stack.
True.
But we're now basically codifying all the things. Oh, wait, these were all the implicit guarantees we had. We now need to make them explicit. We need to be able to handle them when they don't, when these guarantees are no longer provided.
Yeah. It's definitely an assumption that in some sad ways is going to go away, that the security and simplicity of call stack is just not going to be the status quo as we move forward. But I think we'll solve those problems without significant issues, and we'll have better tooling that are structured for that. that are going to be in place is going to make things better overall. It's going to be a paradigm shift.
Yes, it is very much a paradigm shift. It is one, again, where I think people will have to relearn a lot of things that they thought they knew, just because it will take a while until we have made enough progress, you know, as an industry, you know, developers, where we can hide these issues and we can establish enough known patterns that we can... I mean, exceptions is a great example. It took a long time for exceptions to manifest themselves, even in, you know, traditional empirical code, like, you know, C and so on. Nothing to do with altogether. It's just a way of a worldview and coping with errors. And the same thing has to happen again in asynchronous programming. But I think it's unavoidable. And that's why, you know, we are particularly passionate about the topic, and we think it has a lot of importance, even though we are really, in some way, pioneering, you know, a new domain that is still very much, there's a lot of flux in technology, and we may be going the wrong path or the right path, we'll see. But that's why we'll be looking at all kinds of other technologies and compare and contrast and see which ones of them are, you know, more appealing to us for whatever reason.
Yep, I guess that kind of wraps up today's topics about why do we think that asynchronicity is important and why everybody should care, or if not right now for your today's forms of a data application, but for the next thing you're going to be building in the next 6 months, the next year, the next 2 years. And as always, we'd love to get any kind of feedback, and if there's topics or details that we didn't cover, we're very open to pretty much covering anything on future podcasts. We appreciate all feedback.
Yep, and we have a list of other topics, and so if any of you feel strongly about those topics and want to chime in, we'd love to have guests on this podcast to provide an additional perspective on things. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening in, and I hope you'll tune in next time again.
Thank you. Yeah.